Luke chapter 4. Luke is a doctor. He's a traveling companion of the Apostle Paul. And he writes this book while Paul is in prison. And while he is compiling this document, he uses older documents such as the Gospel of Mark as some of his references, as well as extensive eyewitness accounts, because most of the people are still alive. After being baptized, this is how far we are so far. After being baptized, Jesus spent time in the desert being tested by Satan, and he has now returned to the Galilee area up north. It's kind of like going from, out in the desert and then heading up to Northern California, except it's not quite as far as that in Israel. But he's now up in the Galilee area. He started off in the synagogue in Nazareth, where he declared that he was the Messiah. And the people in his hometown promptly rejected him. And he has moved on to Capernaum. We are in chapter 4 of Luke, verse 31. Then he went down to Capernaum, a city of Galilee, and was teaching them on the Sabbaths. Steve, let's do what we did first service. Can you get this bank of lights, or just half of them? The other one. Oh, yeah, that's it. That was it. Good. Maybe we'll see the videos just a tad easier. So, he went to Capernaum. The name Capernaum, it's Kfar Nahum would be one way of saying it. Kfar means village, and it could mean village of comfort. Nahum could be comfort, or it could be village of Nahum, like the prophet Nahum. We're not sure exactly where it got its name. Capernaum, if we look at the map, Capernaum is a flourishing city in Jesus' day on the northwest shore of the Sea of Galilee. The Sea of Galilee lies in the Jordan Valley, or technically in the African Rift Valley, and it's actually 600 feet below sea level. And that's why it says he went down to Capernaum, because Nazareth is up in the hills, Galilee is down. Galilee is always hot, it's always warm, because it's below sea level. And so he went down into it. Capernaum is located on a major trade route known by the Romans as Via Maris, or as the local people, as the Way of the Sea. It ran up the coast of Israel and then comes inland and hooks up by Capernaum. And Isaiah prophesied about this time of Jesus' ministry in Capernaum. You'll see it here in Isaiah chapter 9. It says, "Nevertheless, the gloom will not be upon..." Now, this is Isaiah writing 700 years before Jesus. "Nevertheless, the gloom will not be upon her who is distressed, as when at first lightly esteemed, when he lightly esteemed the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, and afterward more heavily oppressed her by the way of the sea beyond the Jordan in Galilee of the Gentiles." He locates the street, the city, the highway. "The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who dwelt in the land of the shadow of death, upon them a light has shined." We think that this part of this prophecy, it's not only talking about the coming of the light into the world, but it even gives us a location, the area of Zebulun and Naphtali, the way of the sea. That's where Capernaum was located. Jesus spent more time in Capernaum than any other city, and in a way you could call it his home base up in Capernaum. And it says he was teaching them on the Sabbaths. It's a normal thing for Jewish people to go to the synagogue on the Sabbath. Sabbath is Saturday. We worship on Sunday in honor of the resurrection, but the Jews worship on Saturday according to God's commandment to them as Jews to worship on Saturday. Synagogue is a Greek word. It means brought together. And Steve, you can sit down. We're going to leave it off the rest of the morning. Synagogue is a Greek word, which means drawn together. In Hebrew, it's Beit Knesset. That's what they would call the synagogues in Jesus' day. They wouldn't call it a synagogue. That's a Greek word. They would call it Beit Knesset, house of the gathering. The synagogue in Capernaum was a little bit bigger than the ones in Chorazim or Nazareth. Remember 2 weeks ago when I showed you the video of Chorazim? Here's the synagogue in Capernaum. We're outside the synagogue, and we're going to go inside. You see the benches on the side of the wall. We talked about where that's where the wealthy people would be sitting. They've reestablished the columns in the synagogue. That's inscribed on one of the columns. It's in Greek and Latin.
The most popular capital decoration, architectural details. It was placed, of course, on top of a pillar. Pillars would never stood there without a capital. It would be a base, it would be a capital, and a pillar was not just standing there for good looks. Pillar would always support a roof. Now, in this case, we see in the very end of the room that there is a bigger pillar, and those would support a second level. And so what we will do now, we'll go out from the Beit Knesset into what you would call probably back home, fellowship hall. It's slightly different in the Jewish tradition. Let's go over to fellowship hall. Over, again, some more foundation from first century synagogue.
Now, the synagogue in Capernaum, this structure was built 100, 200 years after Jesus. It's built on top of the synagogue that was in Jesus' day. That's what he was talking about. There's a corner where they've excavated down to the synagogue in Jesus' day. It was built out of a darker rock, the basalt, the lava rock. And right next to it, this would be a room like this size, and next to it there was another room that was more long and thin, but it like a fellowship hall. And it says, and they were astonished, verse 32, at his teaching, for his word was with authority. They were astonished. The word astonished, the Greek word is ekpleso. It means to strike out, to expel by a blow. Not strike out like baseball, but to, you know, knock somebody off their feet. To be struck with amazement, to be amazed. And as I was thinking about this and how this word is used, this particular Greek word is used throughout the New Testament. It's all about being amazed at Jesus. I have a video.
Your grace
It is my hope that as we work our way through the Gospel of Luke, if you've lost it, I pray that you will regain your amazement at who Jesus is. And I pray that you will grow more and more astonished, knocked over by who he is. Because he's amazing. He is so amazing. Here it says they were astonished at his teaching. It says, for his word was with authority. When Jesus gave a sermon on the mount, he ended the sermon with these words. He said, therefore, whoever hears these sayings of mine and does them, I will liken him to a wise man who built his house on the rock. And the rain descended, the floods came, the winds blew and beat on that house, and it did not fall, for it was founded on the rock. But everyone who hears these sayings of mine and does not do them, will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand, and the rain descended, the floods came, the winds blew and beat on that house, and it fell, and great was its fall. And so it was, when Jesus had ended these sayings, that the people were astonished, they were amazed at his teaching, for he taught them as one having authority, and not as the scribes. When the scribes, when the rabbis taught, they would expound on the scriptures by constantly quoting other rabbis. What does this verse mean? Well, Rabbi so-and-so says it means this, and Rabbi so-and-so says it means this. Jesus didn't do that. He just told them what it meant because he had the authority of heaven. He knew what it meant. He had real authority. Real authority. And if we're not careful, friends, we can become like the scribes, where we have a lot of words but no authority, and we're afraid to speak up and to say the truth.
God tried to stop me from killing an innocent man, and I ignored the sign. How can I even hope for forgiveness?
I think sometimes it's easier to feel guilty than forgiven.
Which means what?
That maybe your guilt over these deaths has become your reason for living. Maybe you need a new reason to go on.
I don't want to go on. Can't you see? I'm old. I have cancer. I've had enough. The only thing that is holding me back is that I am afraid. I'm afraid of what comes next.
What do you think that is?
Oh, you tell me. Is atonement even possible? What does God want from me?
I think it's up to each one of us to interpret what God wants.
So people can do anything? They can rape, they can murder, they can steal all in the name of God, and it's okay?
No, that's not what I'm saying.
Well, what are you saying? Because all I'm hearing is some new age, God is love, one size fits all.
Hey, Dr. Truman.
No, I don't have time for this now.
Greg, it's okay. I understand.
No, you don't understand. You don't understand. How could you possibly say that? Now, you listen to me. I want a real chaplain who believes in a real God and a real hell.
I hear that you're frustrated, but you need to ask yourself.
No, I don't need to ask myself. I need answers. And all your questions and your uncertainty are only making things worse.
I know you're upset.
God, I need someone who will look me in the eye and tell me how to find forgiveness because I am running out of time.
That's real life. That's real life. And there are real answers to life. There is a place to find forgiveness. There is, absolutely. It's in Jesus. Because Jesus died to pay for our sins. There's no question about this. The authority is in Jesus. He's the Son of God, and He alone can change people. They were amazed at His teaching. Verse 33, now in the synagogue there was a man who had a spirit of an unclean demon, and he cried out with a loud voice, saying, "Let us alone. What have we to do with you, Jesus of Nazareth? Did you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God." So, in the synagogue in Capernaum, there's a man who is possessed by a demon, an unclean demon. Doesn't it kind of seem strange to you that a man with a demon is inside a synagogue? Doesn't that kind of seem like strange? I mean, was this guy one of the regular attenders? Is he one of the guys signing up with East Credit Union, you know? Is he just a guy who wandered in off of the street? My friends, church is a place for broken people. It's a place for broken people. Some people have this notion that they can't go to church because church is just for nice people. I got news for you. They haven't met us, have they? God. Some people think the church is just a museum for saints. But what God's idea of church is that it ought to be more of a hospital for sinners, for sick people. And in a hospital, you're going to find two different kinds of people. You're going to find sick people in a hospital. And you're going to find less sick people in the hospital. I carefully scripted that. So it wasn't sick people and well people. It's sick people and less sick people. Because in a way, we're all just still a little bit sick. And the closer you get to some of us, you realize that's true. There is nobody in this room that is perfect. Nobody. And hopefully, if we are doing church correctly, and those who are sick are becoming, yes, they're becoming well, they're becoming less sick. It's a place for broken people. Verse 35, Jesus rebuked the demon. Jesus rebuked him, saying, "Be quiet and come out of him." And it's literally, the Greek word here is literally, put a muzzle on it, put a stock in it, just shut up. And when the demon had thrown him in their midst, it came out of him and did not hurt him. Then they were all, there it is again, amazed, and spoke among themselves, saying, "What a word this is! For with authority and power he commands the unclean spirits, and they come out." And the report about him went out into every place in the surrounding region. Jesus rebuked this demon. He rebuked him. The Greek word for rebuke is epitemao, which means to verbally correct someone or something. Jesus spoke to the demon. He ordered it to shut up, and it came out. Jesus has authority over demons. The demons tremble in the presence of Jesus. James writes, "You say you have faith, for you believe that there is one God. Good for you. Even the demons believe this, and they tremble in terror." And when Jesus commands a demon, it must obey. Matthew 28:18, Jesus came and spoke to them, saying, "All authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth." They must obey him. And I think, he's also given the same authority to us. In John chapter 14, Jesus said, "And whatever you ask in my name, that I will do, that the Father may be glorified in the Son. If you ask anything in my name, I will do it." He's given the same authority to us. But I think that the best way to handle demons is to let Jesus take care of it. Even Michael the archangel, and if anybody in the universe is the equal of Satan, it's not God. They're not even in the same class. I mean, Satan is hitting in single A ball, and Jesus is the captain of the majors or something. They're not even close. But Michael plays in the same league as Satan. And yet Michael, the archangel, in contending with the devil, when he disputed about the body of Moses, dared not bring against him a reviling accusation, but said, "The Lord rebuke you. Let Jesus handle this. Ask him. Ask him to work. Now, there's a word of caution when we talk about demons. There's some folks that make the mistake of thinking that every illness, every difficulty, every problem is due to demonic influence. And I got to tell you, I wish life were that simple. I really do. I wish it were that simple. The problem is there are plenty of troubles in this life that are not due to demons. Don't give Satan more credit than he's due. There are real physical diseases that are not due to demons. And when you are sick, you go to a doctor. Go to a doctor. There are real mental illnesses. This is something I've learned over the years. Mental illness is a real thing. And if you go to an MD for a physical ailment, you ought to learn to go to the right kind of doctors for mental illness. If you have a mental illness, go to your doctor. Take your meds. Make sure you go to your counselor, your therapist. It's a real thing. Deal with it. Work with it. It's not always as simple as casting out a demon. It's not. Now, are demons real? Absolutely. Have I encountered demons? I believe so. Is Jesus the real deal in dealing with demons? You bet. He works. He's stronger than any demon. But don't blame everything on Satan. Don't give him too much credit. Verse 38. Now, he arose from the synagogue and entered Simon's house, but Simon's wife's mother was sick with a high fever, and they made request of him concerning her. So he stood over her and rebuked the fever, and it left her. And immediately she arose and served them. Now it says he went into Simon's house. This is Simon Peter, who's also known as Cephas. And just outside of the synagogue in Capernaum, here's the Capernaum synagogue is over here. Just right outside the door, they've uncovered a whole mess of houses that date back to the first century. Remember this, Gabe, on our trip. All kinds of houses. The houses closest to the synagogue, which would be this one right here, we believe it probably belonged to the guy who was the ruler of the synagogue. We will meet him a little bit later in chapter 8. His name is Jairus, and Jesus will heal his daughter. This is Jairus' house. A little further from the synagogue, a little more modern structure appears. It looks something like a spaceship. We'll go up a little bit closer to the spaceship. There it is. Now, so we're coming up to this. If we look off to the side, here's all these houses that we were looking at. This is the synagogue in Capernaum. This is how close all this is. Okay, it's real close, real close. It's just like where the offices are.
Here has 8 tubes sticking into the ground, which would be very much like solid fuel engines, and the gangway that is perfectly like a gangway coming out from a space vessel.
There's Deb.
What else can you think it is? Now, if it is a spaceship, it is most likely that the aliens that came here were looking for some Christian roots. Notice the fish.
There's a fish in here.
And it is very interesting. He landed right on top of what, according to archaeologists, is supposed to be St. Peter's mother-in-law's house. Or one of the first places that Christian meetings took place while Jesus was still amongst them. And tremendous healings took place. They're like the healing of St. Peter's mother-in-law. And the healing of a guy that was on a stretcher and didn't have place in the house. And they had to actually remove some parts of the roof to lower him in there. Now, down in the bottom of this excavation, there is a rectangular stone formation. You can see it in the drawing over there. That represents Peter's mother-in-law's home.
That's it. That's the size of it.
Of course, when Rome turned to Byzantine, they started building chapels and churches.
This is the chapel walls on the outside.
They liked the octagonal formation because octagonal is like the number of beatitudes, number of blessings on the mount, not too far from here, which we're going to next. So there was one from the 3rd century, 3rd or 4th century, and that was not enough, so they extended, and this is the foundation. The foundation was left. On top of that, there was a larger chapel from the 6th century AD. Now, Capernaum was an interesting place. Ah, by the way, you heard about the instance where Peter denied Messiah thrice in Jerusalem. There is a rumor out there that says that he denies him thrice because he could never forgive him for healing his mother-in-law.
Rumor.
Come on.
Oh, mother-in-laws are reacting now.
Why not so bad?
Some are, some aren't, you know. Mine is good. Anyhow, but Capernaum was a town, a Jewish town, very Jewish town.
Keep this building, the structure in place, in your mind. Because we think that's Peter's mother-in-law's house. And again, there's lots of reasons why the archaeologists have identified this. One of it is because they had built chapels, different chapels on top of it, because they thought this place was special. There's also stuff inscribed in the stones. We're pretty sure we know what the place was. Now, it mentions Simon's wife's mother. Just a little quick word here. Peter was married. Now, the Roman Catholic tradition is that Simon Peter, who's they call him the first pope, that he was, like all priests, he was not married. Or they might say, well, maybe he had been married, but his wife must have died and Peter was a widower. The problem with this is that even in Paul's day, Peter was still married and he traveled with his wife. We know this from Corinthians, 1 Corinthians 9:5. Paul is talking about why he's not allowed to do things. And he says, well, do we have no right to take along a believing wife, as do the other apostles, the brothers of the Lord, and Cephas? That's Peter. In other words, Peter had been traveling with his wife. So why do you think that we can't do certain things? You know, it was his point. Jesus rebuked the fever. This is the same word that is used when Jesus rebuked the demon. He can rebuke a fever. He can even rebuke the wind and the waves. We'll see in Mark chapter 4. Same word is used both for people, demons, as well as inanimate objects. It says, she arose after she was healed. She arose and served them. And there's a lesson here. I'm calling the lesson healed to serve, because that's what Jesus does for us. When you become a little less sick, and sometimes this is part of the healing process, is you learn to think about other people and you learn to serve others. That's what he does. He helps us be well, and then he says, go and serve. His goal is not to just make another nice statue for the museum. His goal is to make us men and women who are helping him bring healing in the hospital. And what do we call her? She's Peter's mother-in-law. It's Mother's Day. So I should do a Mother's Day video, right?
Right there's the heartbeat.
Do you have any kids?
3, actually.
Wow, that sounds crazy.
Crazy? In the best way possible.
So what's it like being a mom?
Feeling too good.
Oh no. It's okay, Sugar Bear. Let's just go in there.
Sorry, Mom.
Oh. It's okay, sweetie. Next time, we'll just run to the washer.
Why are you watching me sleep?
Because you're my baby boy, and I love you.
Still creepy, Mom.
this mean?
You're grounded for the rest of your life, yes. Yes, it does. So in the future, you and I can just refer to it as the monthly
visitor. Writes out Joshua 1:9, the scripture.
So stupid. Why am I so stupid?
What did you just say to my son?
What?
My son is not stupid. My son is smart. He was formed by God's hands, he was dreamed up by his heart, and he was placed in this world with a purpose. You, my son, could never be stupid.
What? Mom would never do something like that. She's way too predictable.
I know, right?
How's that for predictable, Nostradamus?
There's so much to do. The summer's gonna go by so fast, and we still have to pick out my dorm room furniture.
Slow down.
What?
Maybe I'm not ready to let you go yet.
Mom.
Yes, Mom. That's who I am. Is it so bad that I just want to take care of you forever?
You already have. Everything you've done for me, everything you've taught me. I'll take it with me wherever I go. You have taken care of me. For life.
So what's it like being a mom?
How much time you got?
Happy Mother's Day, moms. You know, if you want to show this video to your mom, go to the website. Look for that little thing on the front page called Downloadable Notes, and you'll get a version of the notes, and there's a link there. You can show your mom. I showed this to my mom last week, and she just loved it. Friends, we have been healed to serve. We have been healed to serve, not to just join a museum, but to serve others in the hospital. Verse 40, when the sun was setting, all those who had any that were sick with various diseases brought them to him, and he laid his hands on every one of them and healed them. It happens when the sun is setting. The crowd shows up after the sun sets, probably because this means that the Sabbath was over. These are good Jews. And so they wait till the Sabbath is over before they start carrying all their sick to Jesus. All those who are sick with various diseases. Kind of interesting because this is Dr. Luke saying this. So he's putting his little doctor's thing in there. They're with various diseases, and he laid his hands on every one of them. Now, if I was Jesus, I would say it's been a long day. See all you people out there? I'd probably do a Benny Hinn on him. I'd probably take my coat and I'd throw it on him and say, all of you be healed! And just everybody would be healed at once. He doesn't do that, does he? He puts his hand on every one of them. He took time for every single person. He's got time for you. You're not just Saint number 156A00. No. Everyone. And he healed them. He can heal anyone. He can heal anyone. There's nothing that Jesus cannot do. Nothing. For some of us, the bigger question that we're asking is, will he heal me? Will he heal me? We came across an interesting verse last Thursday night in our study in the book of Job. A very disturbing verse. In Job 13:15, Job says, though he slay me, yet will I trust him. Though he slay me, yet will I trust him. We often hear people being challenged, do you have enough faith to be healed? And I'd like to suggest that perhaps a more difficult question for some of us is, do you have enough faith not to be healed? What if he says, no, I think you need to go through this. Are you still going to trust him? You're still going to trust him. Verse 41. And demons also came out of many, crying out and saying, you are the Christ, the Son of God. And he, rebuking them, did not allow them to speak, for they knew that he was the Christ. Now when it was day, he departed and went into a deserted place, and the crowd sought him and came to him and tried to keep him from leaving them. But he said to them, I must preach the kingdom of God to the other cities also, because for this purpose I have been sent. And he was preaching in the synagogues of Galilee. It says he needed to go to the other cities also. There's a lesson here, and I'm calling the lesson good or best. There are a lot of good things that can get in the way of the best. If Jesus had stayed at Capernaum, that would be a good thing. But he needed to keep moving on in order to do what God wanted him to do. And that was the best. It's important to find out what the best thing is that we should be doing and not let all the good things keep us from doing the best. An expert in time management, speaking to a group of business students, driven students, overachievers, and he said, okay, time for a quiz. He pulls out a 1-gallon wide mouth mason jar, sets it on the table in front of them, and then he produces about a dozen fist-sized rocks. He starts putting them in one at a time until the jar is up to the top with the rocks. And then he says, is the jar full? And everyone in the class says, well, yes. Then he says, really? So he reaches under the table, pulls out a bucket of gravel. He dumps some of the gravel in, shakes the jar, lets the gravel kind of sift down among the rocks. And then he asks the group once more, is the jar full? By this time, they're kind of onto him. So they say, well, probably not. And he says, good. And so he pulls out from the table a bucket of sand, starts to pour the sand in, kind of shakes a little, let the sand sift in between the rocks and the gravel. And once more he asks the question, is the jar full? And this time they're, no, it's not full. And so he pulls out a pitcher of water and begins to pour it in until the jar is filled to the brim with water. And then he looks at the class and he says, what's the point of this illustration? And one eager beaver raises his hand and he says, well, the point is, no matter how full your schedule is, if you really try hard, you can always fit more things in. And the professor said, no, that's not the point. What the point is, if you don't put the big rocks in first, you'll never get them in at all. That's the issue between good and best. If you're filling your jar with all the good things, but you haven't got around to the best thing, you're not going to have time for it. You're not going to have room for it. Good or best. So it says he departed. One other I want to pull out from verse 42 where it says, this was before he was asked to stay. It said he departed and went into a deserted place. And the lesson, last lesson I want to do is called recharge. Mark gives us a few more details. It says, now in the morning, having risen a long while before daylight, he went out and departed to a solitary place, and there he prayed. Now you got to keep in mind the kind of day Jesus had just had. He'd taught that Saturday morning in the synagogue. Later that day, he's at Peter's house and he heals Peter's mother-in-law. And then word gets out and everybody's bringing their sick brother and uncle and everything. And he spends the rest of the day touching and healing each one. And yet the next morning, he gets up a long while before daybreak and prays. If Jesus needed to spend time with God early in the morning, do you think it might be important for us too, as well? I'd like to suggest that when Jesus gets to the point and they ask him to stay and he says, no, I've got other things I need to do, I'd like to suggest that he probably had gotten his marching orders that morning. And he knew he needed to move on. He had best things to do. Give God time each morning. Spend time every day praying, even if it's just a little bit. Spend time, even if it's just a little bit, reading and asking God to set your course for the day, asking God for direction. Now, with that, this is Communion Sunday. So let's get the lights on. We get the folks who are going to help us with communion. Come on up. And you and I will spend a few minutes preparing our hearts for communion. Okay? Let's pray.